Okay, good morning, everybody. I got just past the hour. This is Dave Vellante, and this is the August 10th, 2010 Wikibon Peer Insight Research Meeting, where peers discuss challenging problems in the data center. And the topic for today is virtual storage consolidation, how organizations are migrating data from Tier 1 to Tier 2 and eventually the cloud. And I'm here at the Wikibon offices in Marlboro with our good friends John MacArthur and Wikibon Stu Vinneman, and Steve Keniston has also graced us with his presence today. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, Dave.
And we're very pleased today to welcome our guest, Sean Macy, who's the Director of Operations and Engineering at Colonial Williamsburg. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Terrific. So the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation, for those of you who don't know, operates the world's largest living history museum in Williamsburg, Virginia, which is, of course, the restored 18th century capital of Britain's largest and most important outposts in the New World. And this college campus-like environment grows pretty dramatically in the summertime, from around 2,500 to as many as 3,500 employees in the peak summer months. And in addition to the museums, the IT organization at Colonial Williamsburg supports hotels and restaurants and various other retail shops. Before we get started, I just want to mention some housekeeping items. If you're not speaking, which of course you are encouraged to do so, if you wouldn't mind, we'd like you to put your phone on mute. Star 6 will do that, and Star 6 will unmute. And I am also manually muting a bunch of lines that sometimes provide some feedback, so we'll make sure that we unmute those lines and give everybody a chance to participate. This call is being recorded. It'll last 1 hour, and if you're on Twitter and you want to tweet, please use the pound Wikibon hash so it feeds to various social media outlets. So let me set up the call. The rapid growth in file storage is forcing companies to find ways to reduce complexity and cut costs, as we all know. And by virtualizing existing filers and creating tiered storage pools, organizations can begin to allocate less frequently accessed data to more cost-effective storage tiers, and potentially including the cloud. And this approach avoids capital expenses associated with higher cost Tier 1 systems, and of course minimizes operating costs associated with file management. And in addition, organizations can simplify migration headaches, which oftentimes, you know, escalate costs. We've seen migration costs upwards of $40,000 to $50,000 per array. And consequently, this can reduce planned downtime if you can eliminate that. So once again, welcome, Sean Macy. And Sean, why don't we start it off? Tell us a little bit more about your role at Colonial Williamsburg.
Well, certainly. My role is multifaceted in IT. Really, I'm responsible for the entire IT infrastructure here at Colonial Williamsburg. I think, as you mentioned, we fluctuate from between 2,500 and 3,500 employees between peak and off-season. We're operating roughly 1 square mile campus of a small town. We have dozens of restaurants that we operate and retail establishments, as well as five major hotel properties, about 1,100 hotel rooms for our guests, ticketing operations, fundraising, and really about anything else you can name that might go on in a small town. We're very analogous to a college campus in that respect. So we have probably 1,200 to 1,300 desktop PC users as part of that operation. And we have an awful lot of storage. You know, one of our missions, as you know, Colonial Williamsburg, is that the future will be available. I should say that the past will be available to future generations, and that they'll be able to learn from what happened here in Williamsburg. So our mission is perpetual in nature, and that we need to make the files, the information, the images, the things that are in our collection, colonial objects, et cetera, available to future generations in perpetuity. So that's kind of what we do here.
Well, I wonder if you could paint a little bit more detailed picture of your shop. You told us you have 1,200 to 1,300 users, a lot of storage. Maybe you could tell us, you know, how much storage, servers, applications that are running, you know, growth, et cetera.
Yeah, certainly. We have, as I mentioned, about 1,300 desktop PC users. Most of them are IBM compatible PC users, but we do have a number of operations, things like graphic art and design and web design, where we have Mac users as well. And we have an environment, about 140 production Windows servers, most of them virtualized. And we have several network appliance filers, basically two clusters at this point of network appliance filers, with one cluster being remote from the other so that we get a little bit of campus disaster recovery capability there. Storing about 100 terabytes of raw storage. And then we have a IBM mid-range system running some of our financials. And we run a very wide variety of applications. So as mentioned, we're running a small town, so we run anything from very small applications like workman's comp insurance and accident guest accident tracking to financial ERP kind of applications. And then, our bread and butter is things like ticket selling. We sell about 1 million both reserved event and general admission tickets a year. And we, of course, operate 1,100 hotel rooms. We've got to be able to take reservations and check those people in and out. And then all the food and beverage and retail point of sale that goes with having all those guests as well.
Great. So, from a file type standpoint, can you share with us the mix? I mean, you've obviously got some reservation systems and some transaction going on, but can you share with us what's going on in the organization from a file type perspective?
Sure. We have really a couple of different tiers or logical groupings of storage. Maybe we shouldn't quite use the term tiers just yet, but we have employees, which are storing the standard stuff that desktop PC users would store, whether that's spreadsheets, Word documents, PowerPoint presentations, MP3s, whatever people store on their personal computers. One of our policies is we try to encourage everybody for a disaster recovery purpose to keep their important documents on network drives and not on the local hard drives of their computers. So the computers are replaceable commodities. So everything anybody stores in the organization is going to be stored on network attached storage, which in our case is network appliance devices. So that's your typical, Word documents and those kinds of things. But then a big part of our mission is preserving this past information. So we have lots of rich media, whether it's photographs of objects in our collections or world leaders that have come to Colonial Williamsburg, or just reenactments of past events or, historically significant things like archaeological digs, are heavily photographed to see what the different strata of Earth look like as they're very slowly sifted away and where the artifacts came out of the Earth as they come out of the ground. Those kinds of things. We're taking photographs of all of that and storing those. And, things like the archaeological digs get stored perpetually. So, we have that kind of information. And then we have a media generation arm that does films and podcasts and music and those kinds of things. We're generating that kind of online content as well. So we sort of have a wide strata of content we're generating and storing. And, some of those things, the music, the podcasts, the archaeological digs, are things we want to make available to future generations for hundreds, if not thousands, of years to come.
Hey, Sean, this is Steve Keniston. So of that mix of your 100 terabytes of capacity, what would you say, percentage-wise, if you had a ballpark guess, kind of the difference between the rich media, the non-rich media file types, and maybe the database? And then what's kind of your top challenges in managing all that content?
Sure. Roughly 10 to 15% of our data is just general end-user data. The Word documents, PowerPoints, the pedestrian stuff that any average PC user is going to store. Most of the rest of our 100 terabytes, so maybe somewhere in the 80 to 85 terabytes of that data is more rich media based. We have more data perhaps than the 100 terabytes I've mentioned. I'm not counting into that the transaction processing databases, associated with things like, selling food and beverage or making hotel reservations or those kinds of things. For my thoughts here, as we're talking about storage, I'm really more concentrated on the storing of those documents themselves and TIFF images and podcasts and MP3s and those kinds of things. But yeah, that's sort of the mix, if that makes sense, if that answers your question.
So this is John MacArthur. I understand you're moving. You've got 80 to 85 terabytes of rich media, and then the sort of, as you said, pedestrian files. On the database side of the house, for all the transaction processing systems, things like that, what's the rough size of that, and how long are you keeping that data, and do you migrate that data as well? Or are we just talking today about the file data?
Well, yeah, I mean, we can talk about all of it. From a virtualized files, though, and using F5, for example, as we use in network appliance in the back-end storage, really the transaction processing databases don't play a part in that right now, other than using some of the mirroring capabilities. But because they tend to be somewhat transient in nature, we don't care to keep ticket transactions from more than 2 years ago. We certainly want to keep your transaction for a full year so that if you show up 6 months later after buying an annual pass and say, I don't know what happened, but we got home and we couldn't find them in the suitcase, and we did buy annual passes and we'd like to get reprints, that we cannot, we can accommodate that. But we don't really have a big reason to look at a transaction for somebody who bought a, margarita at the bar, 2 years ago. Those kinds of things. They're very transient in nature.
So what I'd like to do, Sean, is talk a little bit about your consolidation initiative. I want to talk about the whole tiering strategy and how you've automated that. And eventually, we'd like to talk about your plans or potential plans for doing things in the cloud. So am I to understand that initially, prior to the consolidation, this rich media was being stored on so-called Tier 1 storage? Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, it was.
Okay. Talk a little bit about that, and I presume that's what led to the consolidation initiative, but share with our audience a little background there.
Yeah. Yeah. We can sort of go back a little bit in time. Colonial Williamsburg, perhaps as recently as 7 or 8 or 9 years ago, every department funded their own storage, and typically that took the form of either a Novell or a Windows file server with locally attached storage. And they would store their data locally on that storage, and that led to tremendous inefficiency in an organization our size, in that we had more than 70 departmental file servers out there, and some departments bought enough disk for their needs, some bought way too much, and some didn't buy enough, but there wasn't really any practical way to say, well, the marketing department bought way too much disk, and let's give some of that to the print productions department so they can work on the golf brochures because they're running out of space. So we developed a model a few years ago now, probably 5 or 6 years ago, to consolidate all of those 75 or 80 or so departmental file servers into network appliance storage. And at that point, we did divide it into two tiers. We bought network appliance FAS 250 filers to be the front end for what we called Tier 1 storage, which was end user documents, home folders typically. We're running a Windows domain here, Active Directory, and everybody's got a home folder mapped, and that home folder would reside on network appliance storage. And then the rich media, we moved to a network appliance R200, which was their near store device, and we kind of called that Tier 2. And we consolidated all of the file server information out there in the disparate departments to that R200 file server. And that model worked fairly well for us, but we did run into problems. After a year or two of running in that environment, our end users had filled up the FAS 250 filers. And the issue we ran into there is, without running individual disk quotas, which became a big headache administrative-wise, we would have certain users basically use up all the disk on the FAS 250 for their own purposes, and that would lock hundreds of users because now the other 200 or 300 or 400 people on that FAS 250 were out of space too, and one end user sort of hogging disk space could cause misery for lots of other people. So that was the point where we actually began to look at ways to virtualize that storage and to tier things even further. And in our organization, what we did is we brought in the F5 products at that point and virtualized that first tier of storage and began aging files so that when files weren't used terribly frequently or recently, they got moved off of that tier one, the FAS 250 filers, and into additional disk space on that near store R200 filer. And that always kept a relatively consistently large, fresh set of tier one storage available for end user use without us having to intervene constantly in the IT department and move the files that were less frequently used to that slower SATA disk on the R200 filer.
Okay, so you had a tiering in place. It was just manual and cumbersome,
right.
And you didn't have any kind of automated ILM or HSM strategy, right?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it was definitely a sort of a manual and physical device-based tiering strategy that we had in place.
And no quota system.
And no quota systems, right.
No quota system, no chargebacks?
No, we're not doing any chargebacks for storage.
Right.
Still not doing?
No, we're still not doing that. It's perhaps one of the interesting things of a, we're primarily an educational nonprofit organization, so in that environment it's very hard to assign value to one endeavor versus another.
So can you talk a little bit about, so you put in the F5 technology, can you talk a little bit about exactly what that did for you in terms of the automation and the migration? Just share with us sort of the before
sure.
and after.
Yeah, our initial foray into using the F5 technology was done with the thought that maybe it would help us avoid having to buy more Tier 1 storage. And at that point, we had expanded our FAS 250s from 2 to 3 for end-user storage, and all three of those were full. And we were chronically getting calls at the help desk where our end users, somebody would import something large, you know, an MP3 collection or artwork for a museum exhibit, and would eat up all of the available disk space on one of those three FAS 250s and then basically lock out anybody else from being able to save files. And so it became very painful. And as we looked at ways we could deal with that tiering and automate things, F5 became a very attractive option for us to pursue, and ultimately we did acquire F5 and bring it in. And what we did is instead of buying more Tier 1 filers, more FAS 250s, we just started adding relatively inexpensive disk to the R200. And the R200 network appliance device at the time was very scalable, and you basically added shelves of 16 terabytes of disk to it for roughly the price of adding, you know, essentially 2 terabytes of the front-end fiber channel disk in one of these FAS 250 filers. So by adding the larger shells in the back end of the R200 and putting F5 in place to broker the use between the two filers, what we ended up doing is automating that tiering. And we set a 90-day time frame as our initial tiering criteria and said, if you haven't used a file in 90 days, we'll have F5 move it from tier one to, you know, basically ILM storage on tier two, you know, a dedicated volume on that R200 filer. And, you know, if you go to retrieve that file, it'll get moved back. But until you ask for that file, it will sit on the second tier of storage. And what we found is that freed up about 80% of the disk space on all of those front-end filers pretty much immediately. And so that alleviated any need to add more Tier 1 storage and really eliminated the whole issue with a single user importing a large block of data and locking out everybody else using that same volume of tier one storage. So it really took away all of those headaches very quickly and allowed us to efficiently use that R200 second tier as the place to put the older files without having to enforce very strict file management policies on our end users to tell them that they couldn't keep older files on the network, those kind of things. Those kind of policies are, in an organization like ours, are very unpopular because, given our museum and historical nature as an organization, the tendency is to want to keep things around forever.
I don't think you're unique in that regard, Sean.
Right, yeah. But our end users actually have a little bit of, industry practice to back that concept up,
Right, right. So if I heard you correctly, 80% of the storage on the Fast 250s really didn't need to be there, right?
Yeah, we literally went from, chronically being at 100% utilization on those three Fast 250s to 20 to 30% utilization on them as soon as we enacted the ILM policies.
And Sean, this is Steve again. If you had to maybe quantify from a management, you said before it's kind of a management headache, management nightmare. What's the before and after like now from a management standpoint? I know you said it got rid of a lot of the headaches. I mean, you see less calls to the help desk. How does that work in your environment?
Sure. Well, I mean, at the point where we brought F5 in, we were getting, certainly weekly, if not more than weekly, calls where somebody had filled up one of the three filers by uploading large amounts of data. And the filers were floating around 80 to 90% utilization at that point. And we, basically have to go out and beg our end users to manage their information better and to move, things that weren't as readily needed off of the filers and to some other form of storage, which really circumvented a lot of our intellectual property management policies we were trying to put in place. It's never a good thing if we want to encourage people to keep photographs of Richard Nixon's trip to Colonial Williamsburg available online. If they feel like, well, I can't keep that online, I'll move that off to FireWire drives on my, local workstation, that's not a great thing for the organization, because when somebody leaves, we don't know that they move those objects there, they're not part of the collection, those kind of things. So we really wanted to encourage people to keep things online, but in the tier in which they would be, best kept. And by putting F5 in place, we, emptied those front-end filers to the point where they really became self-managing, where nobody ever turned the tap on so quickly and so hard that they filled them up. And so we didn't have to manage day-to-day or week-to-week how close we were, between 80 and 100% utilization. And really, we just managed the second tier, that back tier of storage, the ILM pool, to make sure that it wasn't filling up too rapidly. But again, then we were dealing with 16 terabyte chunks instead of 2 terabyte chunks, so it was a lot easier to, put 16 terabytes in place and just sort of keep tabs on it up over the weeks and say, well, they're filling it up, but it will be another 2 months before we have to worry about adding more storage. Instead of, 10 o'clock in the morning, you get the call from the help desk saying nobody can save their Excel files, everybody's up in arms. So, that aspect was a huge let off of our help desk and our IT staff from a management standpoint.
So, Sean, did you get any friction from the organization when they found out, or maybe, I'm interested in how you communicated that we were going to implement this tiered storage strategy. A lot of users don't want their stuff on quote-unquote tier two. Did you get any friction there? And I have another follow-up.
That's a good question, and the answer is, by and large, no. Certainly not the average end user who is storing, what I would call your average desk top PC user kinds of content, Excel files, Word files, because the difference in retrieval times between Tier 1 and Tier 2 was not quantifiable or noticeable to them. There was not enough of a, we're talking milliseconds of differences. But we did get pushback from our creative media kinds of people. What we had to do is guarantee them that whatever storage they were going to use, whether it was for editing podcasts or video shorts or whatever the case might be. We would not put them, you know, in a tiered environment with SATA disk. That they would still use fiber channel disk, and that would be available to them dedicated. And we did the same thing with our disk pools that are used for our line of business applications. Those are, you know, still single tier fiber channel iSCSI pools of disk.
And how about, is it common that you have to promote data up to back to tier one, and does that cause any issues?
Common in essentially the way, you know, our policies are set up using the F5, if you decide you want a file, and, you know, I'll pick just sort of a theoretical example, but I'm working on my annual budgeting, and I think about, well, I bought a new air conditioning system 3 years ago for the data center. Let me go find out what that costs, and I want to get that spreadsheet. Well, I haven't looked at it in 3 years. That gets promoted, you know. So when I ask for 2007 budget.xls, that was on tier two. When I go to retrieve it, it gets promoted, though, from tier two to tier one as part of the retrieval. And then I access it and do whatever I do with it. If I don't use it for another 90 days after that, it will go back to tier two again. It really hasn't caused any issues for us. I mean, things do move back and forth between the tiers because of that kind of activity. But we have not seen anybody, you know, recall such massive amounts of information from tier two that it's caused an issue for tier one. And performance has not been any kind of an issue.
So, Sean, just real quick, and a follow-up to kind of Dave's. Do you have any metrics around, like, age of data that gets promoted and how frequently? More of a curiosity question. You said about 80% of your stuff is stale, I use the term stale, but you migrate after 90 days, right? Under the assumption
right.
of it's not touched that much. How about moving back? Do you have any statistics?
We do, and it's a very small percentage. You know, like under 5% of the data moves back. And I think 3.5 or something was the last number I saw. But it's small enough and not significant enough that we don't worry about it, obviously, since I can't tell you a very exact number. But no, it and certainly, you know, what we see on the we get statistics out of the network appliance environment about the seek times and retrieval times on those volumes, and we have volumes dedicated to that those ILM processes, so that you know what volumes of data, if it's being retrieved, that's actually moving out of tier two and moving back to tier one. So you can look at those stats and see. It's certainly slower than the tier one data to move, but we're literally talking about a couple hundred milliseconds versus less than 50 milliseconds.
Okay.
That's that kind of stuff.
So let's do this. I want to just frame the ROI here for a minute and then open it up. I've unmuted a lot of lines and just want to open it up to the audience, see if there's anything there. We really like to get people to interact if they'd like to. And I know this crew has a bunch of questions. And I want to talk about the cloud. So let's start with the business case. So the cost, if I understand it correctly, you've got the F5 solution, which is an appliance you're going to put in front of the filers and virtualize and essentially create a global namespace. Is that correct?
Correct, yeah.
So there's a cost of that, and then you've got, did you have to buy new SATA devices? It doesn't sound like you did. It freed up existing storage, right? So you didn't have to go out and buy new storage with this implementation. Is that right, or am I misunderstanding that?
Well, no, that's right initially. And so what we did initially is instead of buying fiber channel devices, we just allocated SATA disk as tier two and put the F5 virtual appliances, switches, whatever you want to call the ARX switches in front of them
okay.
to manage the movement of data between tier one and tier two. And then the second part of our ROI for us was that going forward then, when we needed to add more storage, instead of buying a split of tier one and tier two storage according to our needs, we bought all tier two storage.
Right.
So we're buying cheaper SATA disk.
Okay, so just on the cost side, just let me start with that side of the equation. It's really just the F5 ARX, and presumably some implementation costs. How long did it take you to implement, and what were the costs like there?
For us, the cost of implementing the ARX solution was pretty equivalent to what it would have cost to add one more FAS 250 filer. So it was pretty much a wash. Very equivalent. I mean, within a couple thousand dollars one way or the other.
Sean, real quick, just when you say a FAS 250 filer, how much capacity?
Now, keep in mind, this was, 6 or 7 years ago for the FAS 250 filers. They were 2 terabytes
okay.
of disk, fiber channel
okay.
disk. Yep.
And then on the benefit side, you're talking about the tier one avoided, which immediately you freed up 80% of your tier one storage. And then
right.
you're talking about the SATA devices cost about 50% of the stuff that was in the FAS 250, right? Did I hear that correctly?
Right, yeah. And actually, the SATA disk cost less than 50% per terabyte than the FAS 250s. To give you a rough idea, of initial, 5 or 6 years ago acquisition cost, a FAS 250 filer was on the order of between $40,000 and $50,000 for 2 terabytes of storage to put on with that storage head and the entire thing and software. Whereas for basically $70,000, you could add 16 terabytes of SATA disk to one of the R200 filers.
Got it. Okay. And so the cost of the boxes is probably similar today. You just get substantially more storage. We're all
lying. Right. Well, that's sort of part of our story going forward is, we did last year a technology refresh and changed out all of the network appliance devices and used F5 to, manage that migration in a completely painless, real-time environment where they'd all move to the new devices and the end users never knew a thing was going on.
Okay, so you got a utilization hit. So you got a utilization hit, you got cheaper SATA devices, and then any other hard costs like reduced migration expense? Do you consider that a hard cost, and can you quantify that?
Yeah, actually, that is a good one to talk about, and I just hit upon that a little bit about doing our technology refresh. But an example of reducing migration costs is, at one point, during our implementation of the EF5 product, we had 3 front-end Tier 1 filers, one of which was at an older version of the Data on Tap operating system, which is Network Appliance's Unix OS. Moving to the new version of the OS for that filer was going to require us to essentially wipe the drive array clean and start over. So we had to migrate all the data off of that front-end filer. And what we were looking at before we bought the F5 solution was literally renting a large network appliance filer for a month or two, migrating all the data to that filer temporarily, doing the upgrade on the existing Tier 1 filer, and then migrating all the data back. And what we managed to do once we put the F5 solution in place is we actually carved out a chunk of Tier 2 disk space as a volume, the same size as the Tier 1 filer, used the F5 product to seamlessly migrate all the data from Tier 1 to Tier 2 for that filer during a day, in the middle of a operational work day. And when the last of the data had been migrated, we wiped that filer, the original filer, clean, upgraded the OS, rebuilt the volumes and queue trees, and then set the F5 product to migrate the data back from the new volume we had created on Tier 2 to the original Tier 1 location. And our end users worked through the day the entire time, retrieving their Word documents and PowerPoints and Excel files. And as the day went on, they were retrieving them from a FAS 250 at Tier 1, and then later in the day, a R200 filer, and then as the day finished, they were back in their original physical location. And, we didn't have to buy any additional hardware or rent anything to do that migration. And that's a process we've, leveraged many times since then as we've moved new technology in or wanted to move data from one drive shelf to another drive shelf.
Do you have any, justifiable way of quantifying what a migration used to cost you? I mean, was it thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands?
I mean, it was tens of thousands. I mean, the our VAR that we work with on network appliance devices was, you know, quoting us a price well in excess of $10,000 to rent a filer for this process.
Right, and then you get, you know, people time associated.
And then, yeah, right, then quite a bit of staff time. You know,
cool.
Which is,
okay, well, that's good. So we at least have the ROI framed. Now, let me open it up. I've opened up a lot of lines. If anybody has any questions, I know we're sort of deep into the call here, but I didn't want to shut you guys out. Anybody in the line have any questions for Sean?
Yeah, this is Rich Ramos. Can you hear me?
Hey, Rich.
Hi, how's it going? Yeah, so it's a question on integration. It sounds like you have users who are using Windows. Sounds like you have back-end NetApp filers, and then in between, yet another company, the F5 Acopia hardware as well. Anytime you have that many different solutions from different vendors involved, usually there's integration issues. Have you run into anything like that, such that if NetApp had integrated themselves or something, it would have been a cleaner solution?
Yeah, I think I get what you're asking about. The answer is largely no. It's been very painless over the years, and you know, we've been doing this for quite some time now. But yeah, there have been a few little gotchas along the way. Most of our gotchas have been related to our Macintosh clients. You know, with Apple developing various revisions of their integration with Windows SIF shares, and that's, we're doing primarily SIF shares for our environment. We have run into a couple of issues along the way where some of our Mac machines were running a version of Snow Leopard that maybe had some issues integrating properly with the F5 product, and the F5 product actually works with a plug-in into Active Directory. And some of the Mac users have had some issues, and we've had a couple of incidents where, you know, we've gotten a new Mac in and it hasn't worked initially, and we've had to, you know, get on the line and talk to network appliance and to F5 and, you know, find that, you know, either there was a patch already available or one that was imminent, and apply that patch to that layer. But it's been it's almost always been exclusively, you know, one rev level of the Mac OS that had an issue, and, you know, a small number of users for us. So it really has been a very minor annoyance. But that's been the biggest area where we've had sort of an integration issue.
Well, that's pretty good. Usually you hear of more. Follow-up on that, you touched on it briefly, but was there some reason users couldn't store directly to either the R200, such that you wouldn't have to have this yet another costly layer to do the migration for you?
Well, I mean, we do have some applications and end users that are storing directly onto the R200, and that's really where we started out, was the users were using the R200 directly as archive storage. The benefit for us, the primary benefit for us of putting the F5 layer in place was automating the movement of files out of Tier 1 to that archive so that the end users didn't have to make a thought process behind it to look at their files and go, you know, this is two-year-old budgetary information. I probably don't need that, you know, at fiber channel speed. Let me move that to a folder somewhere on this slower device. Because trying to get 1,200 end users to manage a process like that is, you know, asking a lot. Whereas by putting the F5 in place, you know, they continue to use, well, for example, my network share is my username $, so SMazy$. So I, you know, map my drive or, you know, just go to /, you know, Colonial Williamsburg storage /SMazy$. You know, 80% of those documents in that share are on Tier 2 storage. I just don't know it. I just see one share presented to me. I manage all my, you know, Sean Mazey files as I see fit, and F5 is in the background making the decisions about whether that is data that should be on tier one or should be on tier two. And we've recently began to expand that for things like PST files. We haven't been able to organizationally bite the bullet and do away with people archiving their email. So at least we can move the email archives off of tier one storage, even if they're used frequently, you know, and say that's not stuff that needs to be high performance. Let's move that to cheaper storage.
Yeah,
and really it takes the end user out of the equation that they, you know, they don't have to manage that or know what's going on.
Other questions that people have for Sean?
Hi, this is Ashmi on the phone. Just a quick question. Did you consider any solutions other than F5? I'm interested in understanding what was very attractive about F5 compared to others.
Well, I'll be honest with you. When we made this decision, F5 was really a pioneer. In fact, actually, when we made the initial decision to move into this, it was the Acopia product, which wasn't even part of the F5 family yet. And you know, they were really the leaders in this you know, virtualization of file namespace. So there weren't a lot of competitors to compare at the time.
So what are the choices were out there that are provide similar functionality? Does Rainfinity, does V-Series? I guess V-Series would do this, right, from NetApp?
That's more new, right?
Right, that's newer. Rainfinity's been around for a while.
But back in the day, though, Sean, what other choices did you look at?
You know, back in the day, we were looking at a number of, you know, virtualization solutions, but to be honest with you, nobody offered the exact feature set that the Acopia and then, you know, F5 product ARX set offered. And nobody offered, you know, we looked at Falcon Store and, you know, a bunch of other vendors that were available at the time. But the other big issue is everybody was very vendor specific. And the very attractive thing about the F5 product to us was it was completely hardware operating system and hardware platform independent. And
so did you do a proof of concept for the product, or did you just kind of see the solution set and deploy it?
We did not do a proof of concept. We actually believed enough in the product that we went right into deployment with it in our live environment.
Great. So, Sean, as a part of kind of what we're looking to do is then we're taking this to maybe to the next level into the cloud. So just a couple of questions. One, if you had to do it all over again today, and this is kind of a two-part question, right, what other things would you consider? So, you know, today primary storage optimization technologies, compression, deduplication, that sort of thing. Do you think those types of technologies would benefit? Would you couple them with your existing solution? And then obviously, kind of part two of that is, as you're moving that data to the cloud, I'm assuming part of that, or looking to move it to the cloud, part of that is cost avoidance, cheaper in the cloud. But it also kind of brings in this spin or this notion of long-term preservation, you're obviously in that business, and protection of that information for a very long period of time. Can you kind of talk about maybe those two avenues, you know, what you would look at, what you might do differently today, and then as you look today to kind of move stuff, you know, probably going through a new technology refresh to move stuff into the cloud, how does that kind of apply along the terms of long-term preservation and protection of that information?
So how about that, Sean Maisie? How would you do it differently?
Sure. Yeah, that's a big loaded question, I think, but I'll try my best. You know, things we would do differently, you know, that there are things that the solution hasn't solved completely for us. You know, one of the issues is backing things up, right? We still have this huge volume of data, and we want to back it up. Colonial Williamsburg is a little unique for an organization in our size because while we have this large volume of data, we're geographically very small. You know, we are one location of one square mile in coastal Virginia. So I don't have, you know, the ability to replicate data to remote offices and mitigate the possibility of, you know, data loss because of hurricane or, you know, human involvement, fire or whatever, that maybe some other organizations would have. So, you know, some of our frustration areas are backup, DR, those kinds of things, that, you know, we don't have a good way of solving some of those issues. And that's where I'm really looking at the cloud as being the answer to those questions. Because while I can, you know, use the F5 product and some of the built-in network appliance capabilities that have been developed over the last 4 or 5 years to deduplicate and be fairly efficient about how I'm storing data on the spinning disk that is here within my 1 square mile campus environment, the fact is I want to make sure that you know, set of pictures of the chairman of the Chinese government coming here and meeting with Ronald Reagan during the G8 conference, those pictures need to be available, you know, in 20 or 50 years. So when people are doing discussions about world political dynamics in 50 years and they want to talk about how the leader of China came and met with the leader of the free world and a, you know, colonial capital and what the significance of that event was, I need to be able to provide them with that information. You know, maybe not me, I won't be around anymore, but, you know, my duty is to make sure that information is available. Well, you know, keeping it here within the Colonial Williamsburg campus is problematic, right? I mean, I'm taking a lot of risks that way. So the cloud looks very attractive to me to be the next tier for our data so that, you know, when you have that podcast or those TIFF images of photographs of world leaders or the, you know, scans of the original 1774, you know, copy of the Virginia Gazette newspaper or those kinds of things, we want to put them somewhere where they have a, you know, better chance of surviving events like Hurricane Katrina or a fire or, you know, loss of a building or a careless tape operator or those kind of things. So, you know, what we're really looking at doing now is using the F5 product to say, as we move things into Tier 2, that's great. Tier 2 is a great way to keep things around that we want to have available locally fairly quickly, but what about Tier 3, you know, where we want stuff to be available forever and ever, and we want to make sure it's in more than one data center and that it's backed up across those data centers. And that's, you know, where being able to use storage from, whether it's Amazon S3 or Iron Mountain or, you know, AT&T Synaptic storage, we can look at using those storage mediums and, you know, still use the F5 product to migrate the data, you know, basically like that's one more tier within our network, even though it's completely outside of the sphere of Colonial Williamsburg.
So, Sean, thanks. That's a good overview on the protection side. Let me ask, maybe on the what would you do today differently from just a pure primary storage solution. So, for example, NetApp's technology has ACES functionality for their primary storage. So ACES doesn't support today, you know, the rich media images, but like a technology like an Ocarina does a rich media type post-process optimization process to further increase your tiers of storage and maybe even add some benefits as you migrate that storage to Tier 2 or backup or the cloud for additional optimization efficiency. Have you thought about doing any of that type of technology?
Yeah, I mean, we continue to look at the storage market. And I mean, to be honest with you, that's one of the, to me, one of the benefits of using the F5 product is because it's not married to any operating system or hardware platform. You know, whether we use Data Domain or, you know, Carina or, you know, whatever, pick a storage platform of your choice, we move things around. And, you know, it really isn't going to matter where the data is stored. And we can still use those, you know, F5 tools to move things from tier to tier, and the tiers will change over time. And that's kind of the benefit if you look at the cloud, right? I mean, the cloud moves. We're not using a network appliance cloud necessarily, right? We're,
right.
You know. So, you know, to me, that is one of the benefits over time, is we can move things, you know, from physical location to location, and, you know, hide that from our end users with this virtualization layer, and that our end users get the simplest, easiest to understand possible view of the network, And in the meantime, we can set our policies to move the data to whatever place makes the most logical sense, you know, whether it can be deduped or whether it's ultra safe, whether it's got RAID 6 or, you know, RAID 5. Those are decisions people like me can make, and our end users don't have to care about that kind of stuff.
So I want to go back to the just sort of the motivation and the business case behind the cloud. So the motivation, if I understand it, is cost, to further reduce cost, and to actually have some physical distance from a recovery perspective or DR perspective. Are those really the two big drivers, efficiency and recovery?
I'd say it's a little more complex than that. You know, I'm not sure. It's not a pure cost play. I don't know that cloud storage is per terabyte that much cheaper than adding SATA disk to, you know, network appliance devices or, you know, pick your storage vendor of choice.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, no one's giving that stuff away. You know, there obviously is a strata of costs available between, you know, what Amazon charges, which is sort of at the low end of the price, and what some other people charge, which is maybe a little higher. But still, it's not purely cost. Certainly the DR is part of it for us, that, you know, we're looking at the fact that if we move data to Iron Mountain's storage or, you know, Amazon or whoever the case might be, that their service level agreements tell me that I can choose to have that data in, you know, on multiple servers, on more than one data center, and that, you know, that provides me some protection there, that if, you know, Meteor strikes Denver, Colorado, and Amazon loses a data center, well, my data is still safe, you know, in Dallas, Texas, or wherever the case might be. And that's something I just can't provide within the Colonial Williamsburg campus here. So that's a capability, you know, that is attractive to me.
Okay. So it's really the tier three terminology really doesn't imply necessarily deeper, you know, the lower cost. It implies the recovery and protection, right?
Yeah, long-term storage protection, exactly. I mean,
yeah.
If you think about the Iron Mountain, you know, business concept that they're, you know, they try to imply that, you know, you're taking all your tapes and putting them in this, you know, mountain-like vault that's going to be protected from everything, you know, short of a planetary collision. Well, yeah, that's kind of what we want to do with the non-tape assets, right? We'd like to move those files somewhere where we have access to them in a fairly timely fashion, but more than anything, we're just concerned that they're protected as much as it can, you know, can be protected without Colonial Williamsburg having to build that kind of a facility in, you know, some town far away.
Yeah, and you know what, there may be a cost play there for the deep archive stuff. I don't know if anybody's on the line that was at the Iron Mountain meeting earlier this year, but they gave an astounding stat about the cost of long-term archive for...
Gary's here.
Gary, what was that stat? Remember that stat? It was unbelievable. It was like 10%
of
cost. Yes,
if it costs you $1 to store a piece of paper, it costs you $500 to read it once.
So I don't know if that means we're going back to paper, but I'm presuming that Iron Mountain's business model is to come up with some kind of lower cost alternative. So for the deep archive stuff, there may be a cost factor there. I don't know. But the business case for Colonial Williamsburg, from what I'm hearing, is very clearly risk mitigation and I guess long-term retention, right?
Right. Well, I mean, the alternative for me is, as you know, we have a staff of photographers, for example, that are out snapping digital photos all day long. That's part of our intellectual property that I need to keep forever. Well, if I don't have a cloud-like solution, I just need to keep increasing the size of my network appliance arrays at the moment. You know, so I just keep adding shells. And I've then got to back all the stuff on that shelf up, and I've got to send those tapes off-site somewhere to protect against, you know, localized disaster. And that's just a model that doesn't grow infinitely very, very well, if you know what I'm saying.
So do you back up the tape today, and what are you doing for DR today?
We back up the tape, and we send it to Iron Mountain today.
Right, okay. So this notion of front-ending the cloud with F5, what do you need to happen in order for this to become feasible?
Nothing needs to happen for it to be feasible. We're already... sort of testing it as we speak. Really what we need to do is just you know, become comfortable enough with it that everybody agrees that is our long-term archive solution, and then we start to move things in bulk, you know, out of that. And we, you know, what I see happening actually for us is that potentially that means tier two doesn't need to be nearly as large. You know, essentially we go to a three-tier model at that point where, you know, we've got high-speed fiber channel disk for immediate access, whether it's applications or end users. We've got a localized tier two disk, which is, you know, maybe the photographs you took last week that you're still working on, you know, putting into the collection and adding metadata to and, you know, commenting upon or editing or whatever. And that, you know, once things go into the long-term collection to be kept forever and ever, that's tier three. And off it goes to the cloud, and, you know, we have a high level of confidence because of our choice of cloud vendors that that data is available across multiple data centers, is properly backed up, and that we don't need to worry about putting it on tape and protecting it and moving it some other place because we've essentially outsourced that.
Is there any integration between F5 and Iron Mountain or other cloud service providers that you'd like to see happen? Is that on, say, for instance, F5's to-do list?
You know, I think maybe it'd be more appropriate for F5 to comment on that, but I do understand that there are some partnerships in play right now with Iron Mountain and F5.
Okay. Is there anybody from F5 on the call that wants to comment? If not, that's fine. I'm wondering if there's an opportunity through, you know, whatever API integration or other, you know, software integrations that could facilitate that kind of implementation. Okay. Other questions?
Yeah,
we've got just a couple minutes left. If you guys have any other questions for Sean, I mean, I think we've covered the ROI. We understand what he's doing with tiering. I think we've...
This is Rich again. I was wondering, in the current solution, is there a single point of failure or a bottleneck with the F5 being a appliance in the middle between the storage and the end users?
Yeah, that's a good question. That actually probably was one of our biggest concerns when we put the solution in place originally. You know, they do provide redundant ARX switches. You know, that's their default implementation, so you have to start with at least two. So there isn't a single point of failure from that standpoint. You've got, you know, essentially a cluster of ARX switches. What we found is, you know, the performance is actually very good, and in some cases it actually improves performance because it sort of performs a caching kind of function, if you will, for the file access. So, in our implementation, the answer is, you know, there has been no performance degradation at all. I think if you maybe missized it and didn't have enough, you know, if you were hiding enough storage behind it, you could probably get to a scenario where that might be a problem, but I would hope your engineers you're working with would make sure that everything was sized appropriately.
Sure, but it does add costs and complexity.
Yeah. I mean, there's sure. No doubt about that, and that is something that, you know, you need to be cognizant of when you're designing the implementation.
So just one follow-up on that. Would you accept, say, a solution that if you installed client software on, say, the Windows and the Macs that gave you features and functionality such that you didn't have to have that interim layer of the heart of the clustered hardware, is that doable, or are you guys totally against installing clients on end-user systems?
Well, we're trying not to. You know, one of the things I'm really aiming for is trying to make the end-user systems as irrelevant as possible. But, yeah, consider any solution. You know.
Just a quick follow-up on that question. Is it the client or agent part of the solution that bothers you, or the fact that it's software versus hardware?
Oh, it's the client side that bothers me, quite honestly. I mean, I'm trying hard to get away from having anything unique installed, you know, on any client system here. You know, we're trying to virtualize our desktop applications and make the clients, as I said, as irrelevant as possible.
So that's a very interesting point because it sort of sets up this other discussion of VDI and cloud storage and just sort of changing the whole paradigm. But unfortunately, we're out of time and we have to wrap. So on behalf of the Wikibon community, I'd really like to thank Sean Mazie from Colonial Williamsburg. Great call today. Appreciate you joining us and sharing your perspectives with your peers.
Well, absolutely. I've enjoyed it. It's been a great call. I appreciate everybody's time.
And I'd like to thank the other Wikibon members who contributed to the call today. Steve Keniston, thanks for stopping by. John MacArthur, Rich Romas. And I'm sorry, Ashmi, I didn't catch your last name, but thank you very much for your comments and your questions. Great as usual. As a reminder, over the next 24 hours, we'll have up on Wikibon 6 research notes pertaining to the call today. And these will have user actions. So look for those and feel free to hit the edit tab and improve the pieces or put up your own pieces or even write a wiki tip. We'll also be producing a podcast of this call and sending that out as well. Thanks for listening, everybody, and thanks for being a Wikibon member. Bye for now.